are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 13th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist, author, former Wall Street insider Nomi Prinz on collusion, how central bankers rigged the world. Also on the program today, Donald Trump seems to have made a deal with imaginary terms and with an imaginary country. Rod Rosenstein acting Attorney General in regards to the Russia investigation, to call on the House of Representatives to investigate its own committee staff members. Meanwhile, a House discharge petition fails. Look for an anti-immigrant bill to hit the floor next week. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is planning concentration camps for immigrant kids. And primary results are in. Dems take a big special election in Wisconsin, and Trumpistas oust Mark Sanford and will be challenging for Virginia's governor. Meanwhile, Trump opens the door to nationalizing our energy infrastructure. Kudos. AT&T Time Warner merger, I guess, well, not quite approved, but passes a hurdle in court. More or less approved. Watch for more monopolistic consolidation going forward. Scott Pruitt at it again. The man is a one-man employment agency for his wife.
My wife.
Massachusetts sues opioid maker and the execs. As a DOJ lawyer quits over the government's Obamacare suit. And lastly, well, not quite lastly, Rudy does it again as his ex-wife accuses him of an affair.
Winning.
Live by the sword, die by the sword is what I say. And lastly, that dancing FBI agent who accidentally shot someone, arrested. Yeah. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, I don't want to look. I don't care what anybody, frankly, does in their marriage or how many affairs they have or any of that. I will laugh about it because just because it's always shocking to me that anyone would have any type of carnal relations with Rudy Giuliani.
Dude, he's 74 and he's still getting it in.
Apparently,
should be an inspiration to everybody in the post 50 market. Frankly,
I will say this though: for a guy who was so horrid to his family, I just remember like his son had to deal with like his dad in the I don't know if it was like marriage number two or three, and Rudy Giuliani. So much of his planning, the planning for the essentially disaster center for New York City was a function of his wanting to have affairs. Like literally,
it's
they
called
put
government,
it,
government efficiency.
They put it, his advisors, I think it was Bratton at the time, also was like, we got to put this in Brooklyn. We can't put it in downtown Manhattan.
I'm not trying to screw in Brooklyn.
Well, that's the problem, is it?
I didn't work my way up from Brooklyn to go back and cheat on my wife in Brooklyn.
Right, exactly. And so they set it down in the World Trade Center 7. which turned out to be a really inconvenient place for it, and particularly bad place, it turns out, to have all that diesel fuel.
I like the idea of a married New Hampshire woman, though.
Like, yep.
Yeah, it's a whole other character there. There.
I mean, so, I
like dirtbag New Hampshire chick.
Do
it's like, oh my God, Rudy, he was like America's mayor. My husband's a cock.
Oh my God, you're America's mayor, and you're in my town.
You went there, and you just were like, oh, my wife has cancer. She's a loser. Wife number three. You want to come over, honey?
And if I remember correctly, Judith Regan was one of those people who worked for, I think it was it Regency or something like that?
Yeah, that's her publishing.
Imprint. Yeah. So,
but she had an affair with the other one, right? I thought it was his police guy.
Oh, wait. Yeah, that was Carrick. I don't remember.
I thought Carrick also used the 9/11 spot.
He used the 9/11 spot while they were digging.
Nice. They were just like, how about we build a place where, like, the firemen can get water and stuff, but I'll use it to bang my publisher instead.
Right. Well,
and Rudy was like, that's government innovation.
I think it's not an either-or situation
you
for them.
There,
I think they felt like they could both get water and have their affairs there. I want to play, actually, this video. No, I want to play... we're going to play the video that U.S. reporters thought was North Korean propaganda until they found out that it was U.S. propaganda. But I don't want to play that now. I want to play the video. We're going to start the show off on a hopeful note today, like a sweet note. I want to play the video of these basically kids from Minnesota, right? But young men from Minnesota,
High schoolers, I believe.
High schoolers. This pitcher, Ty Cone,
that's a great baseball
was
name.
Pitching. It really is. It was a Minnesota high school baseball game. It was, I guess, it was a big game. Like I don't know. I will cop to not knowing much about Minnesota high school baseball, but it was a big game, and I guess it was the state championship. So that's a big deal, and the pitcher is this guy Ty Cone, and he is facing for the final out of the state championship game his childhood friend Jack Cokin. And here is, we'll just watch this. I mean, and I guess I'll narrate it because, you know, some folks are just listening. But Ty Cone pitches the last pitch, and this is what happens. Okay, here's the set. Looks in for the sign. Wind up. The pitch. Called strike three. The game is over. Everyone crashes the mound, except for the pitcher, who runs up to his best friend and hugs him as the rest of the team is celebrating, continues hugging him and, you know, consoling him, walks him a couple of steps towards the dugout, sends him on his way, and then runs out to the mound to celebrate with his teammates.
So sweet, man.
Sportsmanship.
That's
deeper
beyond
than
sportsmanship.
That's real
friendship.
Yeah, yes. Total, it was very sweet. I don't know. I found that to be...
That was beautiful.
Very nice, and it's nice that we can still see stuff like that. That somewhere something like that exists. Everything else that we have to deal with on a daily basis.
Oh, my God, Rudy, do you see that gay kid with his gay friend? Quick, my cousin's coming home. Watch the clip.
It reminds me of...
And then sneak out the back door.
I saw the trailer for the Mr. Rogers movie that's coming up, and
yes.
I just bawled my eyes out at it.
Aww.
And I just think I like...
I think
no,
yes.
We need that. We
I think,
need, we're
I
just
think
starved
that's,
as a culture for
think,
basic
like,
decency.
If you walk through a field of like... all dead grass, and then you just see one flower, you know, it's like, oh my God. And I feel like that's sort of where we are at this point, ladies and gentlemen.
Rudy, are you seeing this?
We got the good news first today.
That's right.
So now we can
beautiful.
Be broken by
there,
the world once again.
That's right. There will be later in the program, in the fun half, we will talk about the primaries. But there was a Scott Walker, Anything you could say about the guy? He knows his state, and 4 months ago he refused to have a special election. We'll just do this. He refuses to call a special election for two seats that are unfilled. One was a state Senate seat. One was an assembly seat. And he wouldn't call the election. State law said you had to. He wouldn't do it. He is brought in front of a federal judge who tells him, for, I think the second time, like, call the election. Hold the election. He attempts to get the state Senate to change the law. But it doesn't work. And the election happened yesterday in Wisconsin in the assembly seat, which was vacant but formerly held by a Republican. The Republican won. But in the state Senate seat, District 1, where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 17 points in 2016, the Democrat, Caleb Frostman, beat the Republican. I think it was fairly close. I think it might have been 51-49. But that is, do the math, at least an 18-point swing. So that's pretty nuts. And obviously, you know, this is the heart of Coke money country. I don't have figures as to how much money poured into that race, but clearly the Republicans were highly motivated, and Scott Walker was ringing the alarm bells a couple of months ago, and I imagine now he's still ringing those bells. So one more piece of evidence that there could very well be a wave election happening. But you know, we shall see. We will go over some of the other wins. The only other sort of, I guess, top line stories are that Mark Sanford, who will be, I guess, leaving Congress. He lost his primary to spend more time with his hiking companion. I don't know if they've got married, but Scott Sanford also.
Oh, I think him and that chick are done.
Oh, did they break up?
I think they broke up.
Oh, all right. Well. Yeah. Nevertheless, he was a critic of Donald Trump's. He got ousted by a Trumpista, and Corey Stewart, is that his name?
Corey Stewart.
Yeah. A, full on alt-right, white supremacist friendly, rebel flag touting, anti-Semite. He won his primary in Virginia. And even places like Red State are saying that we've just lost the gubernatorial election.
Senate. He was a gubernatorial nominee.
Senate against
cycle.
Tim Kaine, right?
Or
right, he ran against
Gillespie.
Right.
Now he's going up against Kaine.
Yep. So
a battle of bigotry and boring.
That's right.
Head to head.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nomi Prinz. Just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its 98.3% of its revenue. If you have the ability to become a member and support the free part of this show, head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every single day. You don't have to listen to it, or you can listen to it exclusively. Don't even listen to the first part of the show. You can listen to part of it. It's completely up to you. Jointhemajorityreport.com. All right, quick break. When we come back, Nomi Prinz.
Well, everybody in the bank line knows that I got a crush on the new teller. It's plain as day, I might as well tell her. She looks my way and she knows quite well her. Well, everybody in the other lines, they smile at me the way I'm blushing. I let them pass me cause I'm not rushing. I got a crush on the new teller. She looks at me and she knows. There's only three in the other lines in my line. I count 11, well, that's fine, cause I'm in heaven, and I got
crush on the new teller, and she looks at me and she knows. Let's go.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome, I believe, back to the program. I believe she's been on a couple of times. Author, journalist, former Wall Street insider Nomi Prinz on her latest book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Welcome back to the program, Nomi.
Thank you so much for having me back, Sam.
So, all right, let's. I want to just before we get to the premise of your book, I want to just back up a little bit and give folks a little bit of either a refresher course or a primer on the concept of central banks, on the Federal Reserve, how it works in this country, and then we will. Start in the aughts, perhaps, and work our way through the financial crisis and how central banks have responded since then. But give us a sense, what is a central bank?
Sure. So a central bank, the easiest way to think of one is it's a bank to banks. That's its primary function, which is basically a lender of last resort in an emergency situation. If there's sort of problems in the financial system, the economy, or so forth, then it's their job to ensure that the private banks can still function for various reasons. Now, they have other jobs. They're supposed to be the regulator of those banks as well in return for providing them with that lender last resort capability. They are also supposed to monitor the level of the cost of money, meaning interest rates. So, for example, the Federal Reserve, which is our main central bank in the United States, created by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, can adjust interest rates up or down in order to balance the level of inflation in the economy, as well as to get the economy to what they consider to be full employment. That definition is, you know, sort of up for grabs, but that is some of the things they look at as well. Their day job, though, really is to ensure that the private banking system is functioning to the best of what they perceive the necessity of that private banking system to do.
And so we should just say, I just want to reiterate one point there that you made. They have a dual mandate, which is to monitor inflation and the cost of money, and to provide for full employment, which, you know, like you say, has, you know, in the eyes of the beholder, I guess. And just remind people, like, that it's, despite the fact that it is created via statute, it is not a government agency like even the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a government agency but finances itself through fees that it collects or through fines that it collects, right? I mean, so what is it? What is there anything analogous to its place as an agency, if you will, in this country?
Well, it really runs as a sort of corporation within the connection to the federal government. I mean, it was called the Federal Reserve to a large extent to give it that sort of association with the government. At the same time, the narration of how it was supposed to behave was independently of the government. So, I mean, it does exist in the middle of Washington, D.C., where all of the other important government buildings are. It also has, it's part of a 12-branch Federal Reserve system with different components of the Federal Reserve system in different cities, which were supposed to embody or reflect kind of where banking and activity and commerce and so forth were occurring in 1913. That said, Wall Street, the New York Fed, happens to be the second most powerful Fed after the one in Washington, D.C., which is the one where the place in which interest rates are actually set, meetings are had to do that and so forth. What it was comprised of are the private banks. They're members. of the Federal Reserve. And why I say it's like a corporation is because they effectively own shares in the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve basically pays them dividends on those shares, much as you would have in any kind of a company, based on the proportion of shares those various banks have. So the way it was set up, and we don't get reports on this anymore, reports stopped happening actually in 1941, is that the bigger the bank, the more shares they had at the Federal Reserve. Of course, where it's different from a company is that the Federal Reserve actually can, by virtue of moving money up and down in terms of its cost and interest rates, and also is supposed to regulate the banking system and is also supposed to be the lender of last resort to the banking system. There's a lot of conflicts of interest in that. Right. Where it also, though, ties to the government is that the president in our country, different countries either appoint the heads of their central banks. In our situation, we actually have an appointed method where the president appoints someone and then Congress is supposed to decide whether or not they reject or accept that person as the head of the board of governors. Again, you could consider that a board of directors. It's the board of governors is what it's called. Again, that connection between government and private of the Fed. And there's never been a situation where Congress has not accepted the appointee of the president. So there's a very close association there politically, despite, you know, it's sort of independence. I say that in quotes as a body.
Okay. And so, all right. So let's go back to 2008, the run up to the financial crash. I mean, just we've spoken about it ad nauseum on this program, but just sum up exactly what you know, what led to this? And then let's talk about the Fed's response. And then we'll broaden out to the sort of the international response that we're seeing.
Sure. So the way the financial crisis happened, was there a couple of components. One is that the level of subprime mortgage rates or mortgage rates had been rendered extremely low by Alan Greenspan, a former head of the Federal Reserve in the beginning of the 2000s, 2001, 2002, to thwart a recession and corporate scandals and all sorts of other things. So at that point, rates were very, very low. What banks did was they wanted to make more money off of those rates, so they started lending lower and lower quality mortgages, and that wasn't necessarily the problem. The problem was that they scooped up these mortgages and they repackaged them into all sorts of other securities. And the way, real quick, the math of finance works is if you, for example, if you and I, Sam, create a security together and you're paying a certain percent on your mortgage and I'm paying a certain percent on my mortgage, then collectively we are paying a certain percentage into some combined asset, some combined security. If you stop paying your mortgage, half of that interest doesn't come into that security. That's kind of what happened in the run-up to the financial crisis. Lots of mortgages were packaged up. The assumption was they would pay the rates that they were supposed to be paying, particularly subprime rates, which were very high, offered a lot of money into these securities, which made them attractive for banks to create and sell and make money from to investors and countries and municipalities and so forth throughout the world. But the problem was when those mortgages stopped paying, those loans stopped producing money into these securities collapsed. The bigger problem behind the securities collapsing was that banks who created these securities, who knew they were collapsing and created them anyway, lent money to other financial institutions like Lehman Brothers, like Bear Stearns that no longer exist, that collapsed 10 years ago, and basically said, you can buy our securities and you can buy even more of them than you might be able to afford because we will lend you money to do that. So not only will we create securities that we know to be faulty, we will lend you money to buy them. And the collateral that you are using to borrow that money are the securities themselves. So a lot was predicated on sort of very faulty loans. So the mechanism knew this and did it anyway. So when everything sort of collapsed, that was when the financial crisis really hit. Banks had lent to each other. The securities, the assets, the toxic assets they had created had no value. They could no longer get rid of them. People who did buy them couldn't receive income from them and therefore couldn't repay the loans they had taken out to buy them. And the whole entire financial system at every level therefore seized up. And that was why in the fall of 2008, there was such a panic in the markets and the banks and so forth. The banks that did survive wanted to ensure their survival. That's where the Treasury Secretary at the time, he was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. When I was there, in fact, Hank Paulson, the New York Fed president, Tim Geithner, a lot of the big bankers, Jamie Dimon, who still runs JP Morgan Chase, Lloyd Blankfein, who still runs Goldman Sachs and so forth, got together and said, we need help. Now, they say they didn't say that we need help, but they needed help.
Right.
They got help from the Federal Reserve. They got help from the government. They got help from taxpayers. They got help from the Treasury Department. Most of their ongoing help has come from the Federal Reserve.
Okay, so so we have this situation where you know, the side bets on side bets and people loaning money for the side bets so they could make a bet with them back, essentially. This thing collapses. And I mean, when we talk about the initial bailout, right, and when we're talking like in the fall of 2008, I guess, and into the early 2009, this was real, right? I mean, the collapse, it seems to me, was real. The question was less as to that something needed to be done, but rather what should it be? Is that right? I mean, you know, because I think there's, what's your opinion on that?
Well, the collapse happened because of all these layers of bets of leverage, of borrowing against things that were faulty and so forth. And this idea that it could go on forever, and then it couldn't. And that's why banks couldn't run their day-to-day operations. I mean, that's why it looked like a crash. They didn't literally have enough money coming in. They do things on the margin. They do things on the edge in terms of operations, and it had seized up because they weren't receiving, you know, any of the payments on the loans they made against these assets. So that all was real. The way in which it was responded to, however, could have gone in a lot of different ways. Now, it was real because all of these loans and side bets and leverage and credit derivatives and insurance against all these things that were created were predicated on the money continuing to flow between the banks. It had nothing to do with Citizens. It had to flow between the banks because they're all backing each other up. AIG, an insurer, was backing them up, and other types of insurers like AIG. That was the biggest one that got the $182 billion bailout that went straight to the banks that were involved in it. So the government became the insurer of these toxic assets. That was one choice it made in the real situation where money had seized up. Now, lots of other things could have been done. Going back to sort of the example
and just,
of you and me
wait,
having
let me,
mortgages.
All right, let's just, before we get to that, I just want to make something clear. So we're not talking about, this is not a liquidity crisis. This is not like, I own a lot of valuable stuff, I just can't turn it into cash. It's that all the stuff I own turns out not to be valuable at all, and nobody wants to buy it. Right. So it's not a.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was both, actually. It was a little bit of both. And it depended very much on the assets and on which institution had lent against them and whether they could get money back at that moment. So,
okay.
For example, Morgan Stanley was facing the abyss because they literally didn't have the deposits, the other assets on their book to sort of utilize in this capacity, which is why they asked the Fed to turn them into the bank and into a bank to get money from the Fed. And the Fed said, okay, sure. Did the same thing with Goldman Sachs. So yes, those banks were looking at liquidity crises. The bigger banks were looking at a situation where they had assets they weren't receiving money back on for the loans that they had given other financial institutions and each other on the back of those assets. They were losing money. They could not get rid of them. And so that's where that part of the situation where simply what they had created had no to little value, and therefore they couldn't move it anymore. So it was like, you know, it's like a clog in a drain. It's like, you know, there could be water behind the clog, but it's like if it's too big, it's not going anywhere until you sort of clean it out. And again, that's what the Fed came and ultimately did.
And the issue at that point, my understanding is, I mean, they had two sort of, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they had two major, I guess, options. One was to save the banks by giving them money directly, or to save the banks by giving homeowners money directly, paying off their principal essentially, and or parts of it, and allowing them to pay the banks, right? Because it either flows one way or the other. If we give the money to the banks, they'll loosen up their things and they'll maybe give some relief to the homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages, or we can help the mortgage holders and they'll be able to pay off the banks, and all of a sudden those assets that they have won't be as toxic. Am I right in that assessment that there were basically those two broad directions this help could come from?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and you've said it very clearly and very beautifully. I mean, my book that I wrote that came out in 2009, It Takes a Pillage, basically had an entire chapter on what you just summarized, which is that it wasn't really the fault of the mortgages or the little guy. It's the fault of how that was all combined into this sort of bigger, massive leverage system, and so that was really the problem. So had you given money to the homeowners, had it even gone directly into these mortgages, you know, forget giving it to them in their hands, but had you literally, or the government or the Fed, literally created a situation whereby that money was funneled into these mortgage payments over a period of time, then a number of things would have happened. And not guessing would have happened. This is like mathematically, financially, what would have happened. What would have happened is the assets that were reliant on these mortgages to keep paying them would have continued to receive money. It would have, in a way, also helped Wall Street. That would have been an option that would have helped the banks and helped people. That would have been the cheaper option. That would have been the better option. That would have been the less time-consuming option.
And guaranteed. And guaranteed, because you're putting it into, you're basically putting it into a pipeline. And nobody has to think about it, right? Like, I mean, if you pay off those mortgages, the money just flows automatically. And my understanding is that that Barney Frank tells the story that that Paulson was willing to pursue that option, or supposedly willing to pursue that option. And that Bush basically said, I need Obama to sign off on this. And then Barney Frank went to Obama and said, Paulson's just waiting for you to say to him, give it to the homeowners in some fashion or another. He could pay directly to the banks, but as a credit on their mortgage in some fashion. And Obama said, no, we only have one president at a time, because he was president-elect at this time. And Barney Frank said, the real problem is we don't have any president right now. Now, who knows? You know, that's what Barney Frank says happened. I don't know why he would lie about it. Who knows what Obama's perspective on it is, and whether or not Paulson was sincere. But that's what it could have gone the other way.
It could have. Now that could have happened, though, after he was elected. What would have happened before he was elected is that they faced the scenario before the elections, right? So the scenario of Lehman Brothers having gone bankrupt, of Morgan Stanley facing potential bankruptcy, and Goldman Sachs potentially going next because they were the most leveraged against these assets, and they had bought the most insurance against them, which was now worthless, and not protecting them. You know, they were the ones on the firing line, and again, Goldman Sachs was Hank Paulson's old firm. So I don't know what conversations, and I, you know, don't need to dispute I can't really dispute or confirm what Barney Frank said, anyone said after the election. But before the election was when these decisions were initially happening. And before the election, when Lehman Brothers had failed, and, you know, it's Sunday night, there's a decision as to how these banks that are still standing are going to be able to remain standing, there were two choices. And the problem that I think happened, not having been exactly in that room, but just, you know, having followed this a very long time and having and fully understanding how securitized assets work, because I had been in my career at Goldman, at Bear, at Lehman, and so forth, actually creating them. I know the math, I know the computers, I probably wrote half the programs for those things. But the reality is that in that moment, the choice was made to pay the banks directly. It came originally through an AIG bailout. It came through various mergers with government backing, you know, starting in March with Bear Stearns into J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, continuing with Merrill Lynch into Bank of America around that same week. Those are all things that happened before the election. And based on those decisions, there would have been no time. There could have been. But based on the decisions, there would have been no time to make those mortgages whole. And not even buy off the houses. You could have done this actually just giving a pledge to pay off the interest, all of it. For an extended period of time, which would have been even cheaper than paying off the entire mortgage. And that would have been a way to sort of balance any, you know, sort of ideological, like, issues with, you know, paying people versus paying banks. I mean, there's different ways this could have gone down. But the reality was there was vast chunks of money that were required quickly, because it wasn't enough to wait. That's how bad it was. It wasn't enough to wait for the interest payments on these mortgages to come into these assets. They needed that money immediately to continue to have day-to-day operations in these institutions. And so the decision was made to allow them to do that. Now, they could have had a stay. They could have done what FDR did. There could have been a bank holiday. But lots of things could have happened to sort of elongate the time by which banks could have fixed their positions, and we could have instilled this payoff of interest or partial mortgages or whatever process. But in those moments, that decision was not taken. The decision was taken to create money to basically pay for the operations of the institutions that were potentially going to fail as well.
Okay, and do you think that decision, how would you characterize that decision? And not in terms of, like, obviously the implications of it down the road, but in the minds of the people who made that decision, was that decision made because of a practicality? Was it made because of, you know, like a quasi ideology? Like, look, you know, banks are responsible people. Mortgage, you know, if we start paying off people's mortgages or interest on their mortgages, you know, that's like we're letting the inmates run the asylum type of thing. But bankers are very responsible, despite the fact they had a lot of evidence to the contrary. But bankers are very responsible, and we're still maintaining, if we give bankers the option of helping people out, we know they're going to do the right thing, supposedly, we have maintained the integrity of the hierarchy that we want to be there in our banking system.
And that's exactly it. The reality is the ideology of even conceiving that one could help homeowners or you know, their mortgagees versus the institutions that lent to them and then leveraged those loans, in some cases, literally hundreds of times throughout the various securities that were created and sort of linked to each other and sold and sparred against and all sorts of other things, the decision was made to accommodate those decisions as opposed to accommodating the individual decisions. And again, it could have been done without that ideology, without the relationships, without the partnerships between the largest financial institutions facing, you know, sort of all of this drama and potentially additional bankruptcies, and the government being very, very connected to them. I mean, just going back to what you're saying about Frank and Obama, I mean, Obama was still not yet elected, but he was certainly getting a lot of money from Goldman Sachs and so forth into what became his election. And so, you know, there was a lot of conversations amongst all of these people that in order to keep the status quo, in order to keep the financial system alive and as it was, the decision was made to sort of trust these guys, and they were all guys running these institutions going forward, rather than give money to the mortgages. Now, again, I say that you didn't have to give money to anybody. The money could have gone directly into these institutions, and that could have been the creative fix for this, and they could have spun it any way they wanted to spin it, and it would have worked very well towards plugging these holes. It just would not have worked as quickly. So it would have required, you know, just more intensity, more stress, more conversations, more, I don't want my bank to fail, you know, said Lloyd Blank's client to Hank Paulson because it's your bank too. You know, all of those conversations that happened were about relationships and ideology, power and money.
Right. And ultimately also just not, you know, they would refer to it as a moral hazard. If you just can't let the little folks think that they're going to get a bailout, because they're going to get that bailout maybe someday at our expense, and we would rather it go the other direction. And all right, so we move past that. The banking system is, I guess, gets a life raft for that time. And as we go forward over the subsequent years, is quantitative easing the sort of the long tail of that decision? Essentially, where, and if so, explain to us what quantitative easing was/is, and if not, explain to us what were the subsequent steps that were taken that basically locked in that dynamic.
Right, and when we say locked in, I just want to embellish upon what you said: subsidized these banks for the last 10 years, because what quantitative easing is, and it's a really wonky, just unnecessarily obtuse phrase. But yeah, the idea of quantitative easing is basically conjuring electronic money in order to purchase assets, bonds, things from banks, or the markets, depending on the different central banks that wound up doing it throughout the world and what they chose to buy with the money that they conjured to buy it with. The Federal Reserve, going back to what we were talking about before, created by an act in 1913, never had a cap. Never had a limitation as to how much money it could create in an emergency situation. No one conceived at the time that it would create, as it has, $4.5 trillion worth of money in order to buy assets. That was not something that was even discussed. I have, you know, many, many pages with very solid sort of footnotes and documentation of old conversations that happened in Washington in the 1910s and sort of afterward into the act in my last book, All the President's Bankers. That was never something that was determined. So basically what that meant was, in the wake of the financial crisis, because simply paying off AIG to continue to secure the assets that were left on the books of these banks that didn't have any value required money from the government. That required sort of an act of a combination of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department deciding they wanted to do that. In addition, there was TARP, there was this Emergency Economic Stabilization Act that basically created a fund of $700 billion to continue to help. That was a taxpayer-based fund. Supposedly that was all paid back, but it was paid back with Federal Reserve conjured money funds. That is quantitative easing. What they did was create, for example, one of the buckets of that $4.5 trillion of electronic money the Federal Reserve created, literally by flipping switches onto their member banks, onto the largest member banks, and sort of distributing it in that manner, as if, you know, a regular person goes through the ATM and their $1,000 balance is all of a sudden just like a $100,000 balance. It's just, you know, thanks. That purchased $1.75 trillion worth of mortgage assets. That's 26%. Representative of the entire mortgage market of the United States, which is on the books of the Fed right now and was connected into some of these toxic assets and assets that were priced or valued related to whatever the level of toxic assets would have been at the time. And in doing so, provided money to the institutions that could get rid of them in no other way, that could not get money in any other way, and instead sort of pledged these assets to the Fed in return for money that overvalued them by a significant amount and subsequently used that money however they wanted to use that money. There was also no limitation on how banks could use the money that the Federal Reserve was conjuring to give them in return for assets that were worth much less than the money they gave.
Now, all right, so here's one thing that strikes me. I mean, the idea of conjuring money, right? Like, I don't think, in my opinion, there's not necessarily something wrong with conjuring money. We're a sovereign state. We have the ability to print as much money as we want. We're no longer tied to the gold standard like we were in 1910. All money in many respects is conjured. It seems to me the issue with quantitative easing, to the extent that it was problematic, right? Because we've been through three versions of it where just the Fed poured money into, you know, they basically had a Venmo account that could just, you know, endlessly keep paying off the banks. That's what it was. They just had a Venmo account that just was bottomless. Let me ask you this. Let me phrase it this way. Is there anything inherently wrong with that? Except for the fact that, again, they have made this decision to pay the banks directly with no obligations for this money, as opposed to we're going to take our Venmo account and we're going to either pay the homeowners directly or say, hey, guess what, homeowners? Here's a letter in the mail. We just paid off 20% of your mortgage, or we've paid off your interest on your mortgage, or whatever it is. And that's the way that we're going to pay the banks. It's going to be automatically credited to your account, but the banks will end up with the money. Is that the problem, or is there something inherently wrong with the idea of conjuring money?
Well, yeah, the idea of conjuring money in this sort of extent, because we're basically talking about conjuring money worth a significant portion of all the assets that the major banks hold. So, I mean, you're basically talking about, you know, sort of subsidizing the private banking system with a body that was supposed to have regulated the private banking system, and that is supposed to, you know, sort of do this dual mandate of unemployment versus inflation, that's supposed to just be there as an emergency lender of last resort. So we're looking at a 10-year emergency policy, number one, which has effectively subsidized the private banking system, who were the major banks at the core of creating the financial crisis to begin with yes, no ties, no remorse, no ramifications. They have some, you know, $110 billion of settlements that they've paid off throughout the years. But, you know, if you're getting a lot of money for overvalued assets over a long period of time, it's kind of easy to pay your fines, and then you sort of deduct
right.
them from the other
right.
side.
Right,
it's really not a hardship.
I'm putting aside the moral, I mean, I think it's morally repugnant. And it's clearly unjust. There's no accountability. But I'm saying, mechanically speaking, aside from the fact that they decided to do it that way and rely on the good graces of these unaccountable, in my estimation, morally repugnant institutions and people, aside from that element, from a mechanical standpoint, is there anything inherently wrong with or problematic with the conjuring of this money?
Well, the problematic element of that is that they've artificially created markets in which real people are functioning and other institutions like private banks and bigger companies are functioning with this extra benefit of having access to this conjured money. I mean, it's not like banks, because they were getting money at zero or near 0%, were giving or helping, you know, people restructure their mortgages on right. anywhere near that. In fact, it became harder and harder for people to both restructure their mortgages as well to take out mortgages now relative to how easy it is and remains for banks to receive this money. So, I mean, it's basically created a far less stable and unequal financial system
right.
By virtue of having had no checks or balances or anything else. It's created inflated markets. It's created inflated debt throughout the world, because it's been so easy for the larger institutions to sort of borrow to buy their own stock, which has then inflated artificially the stock market and so forth. So what has happened is you have this institution that has utilized itself in ways that it was never supposed to have done. And this is not just the Federal Reserve in the United States. This is the Bank of Japan in Japan. It's the European Central Bank in Europe. And these institutions, by virtue of not having to report or explain or whatever how their money is created and where it goes, have been able to make choices and play favorites in the market. Your favorite is J.P. Morgan. Your favorite, you know, some large German company relative to a small Greek company. You know, your favorite is, you know, a sort of well-connected Japanese businessman's company versus, you know, a bunch of middle or smaller business people starting out your sort of new technology or new AI or whatever. I mean, it's actively been a process by which these institutions that were not designed to do this have literally become the funders, the economy, the financial systems, the inflation component of the markets, the artificial stimulation to the sort of entire global economic and financial system. That has ramifications politically, because it means people aren't necessarily getting that money, or choices are made that keep them out or reduce their you know, sort of trajectory towards financial stability at the you know, sort of favoritism of the other institutions. It changes voting patterns, it changes economies, it changes the lending structure to smaller businesses and so forth. It's inherently good for the people that benefit. It's good for the institutions that benefit. It's good for whoever's participating in those markets at a level where that money doesn't come directly from the money that they need to feed their kids or to go to school or to provide for their health. But it's not good for the rest of the economy, because it created a situation, and it continues to push this forward, where you know, large swaths of smaller companies and individuals cannot keep up with this subsidy that has been provided. And it's a $21 trillion subsidy by the major central banks throughout the world to sort of the top of the financial system.
Okay, I think is the most important point that I want people to be able to walk away from, because I think there are times where the idea that the central bank can conjure money is the problematic part. And frankly, the problem is not that they conjured money, it's who they gave it to. And that they gave
That's
it
right.
to one unique class of
That's
people.
Right.
And when you do that, like, it's like, we're going to take, there's two boats entering into a harbor, and we're going to take one boat and we're going to just make it 12 times as large. And so what happens is the
right.
other boat is caught up in that other, you know, the bigger boat's wake, they take on water, and that's what's happening. And they gave that big boat to about
5 to 10% of the people in the world, and the other 90% are in the tiny boat that is getting tossed in the waves, that is unable, you know, it's flooded their engines. I mean, you know, everybody can extend their boating metaphors here. But that's really the problem, is not so much the Fed conjuring the money and distributing it, but how they distributed it in such an unequal fashion to people who were using that money to basically just hand it back and forth to each other and create more money by that process.
That's right. And that's why, you know, I call my book Collusion, because the deception inherent in that, that really this money was supposed to have gone into the financial system to sort of fix it and then be on-lended in a sort of proportional manner to the rest of the world, rest of the population, et cetera, is really the core deceit in this entire process. And so, yes, that really matters. I use a lot of boat analogies, too. I consider it like the Titanic. If I get a bunch of life rafts, and they went to all like the rich people in upper class, and everybody else drowned or froze. We all saw the movie, so it's basically and know the history. But it's basically like that. It's those choices that have been not just created in advance, because they also have them. And these were the same central banks that missed all of this, and it's mostly the Fed that missed our financial system, because we basically screwed up the world. And it's been the Fed that's required these other central banks to help. The reason there's so much of this going on throughout the world, aside from the fact that these central banks in other areas are pretty much G7 areas are realizing that they can actually determine the path of finance and the economy in their own countries. But that the Fed started this. The Fed could not alone, without the Bank of Japan, European Central Bank, Bank of England, and so forth, have actually saved our banks. And had actually continued a policy of subsidizing them and giving money through them to this top 5 or 10% who are participating in financial assets versus kind of real ones. And that's the ongoing problem as well.
All right. So Nomi, your assessment of the ongoing mistake that is being made, which is to concentrate the money in an increasingly smaller group of people and sectors, and to just keep pouring money into it is going to lead ultimately to a crash that is going to, I don't know if dwarf 2008 is the right term, but it is going to lead to another crash. What would be the institutional fix, if there is a fix here? Is it to democratize the Fed in such a way that there are other players on there who could say, like, hey, wait a second. No, the money's going into too few people's hands. Let's turn that machine back on. And instead of, QE4 being, you know, handing money to bankers, let's put it on a helicopter and drop it out the window or something. Anything like that would be better.
Well, I mean, and it, you know, the whole helicopter Ben analogy of sort of dropping the money and hoping it will go somewhere, that was, I talk about this in my book, but inclusion, but that's where it was actually Brazil's finance minister, actually head of their central bank at the time, who sort of coined the phrase, because it's like, what do you expect will happen? You drop money at the top. Where do you think it's actually going to go? You think it's going to get to the ground, or you think it's going to, like, go to the pockets of these people? Well, that was in 2009. We know what happened. And so I think this is still ongoing, and I think the only way to dial it back it's not necessarily to create a sort of companion QE in this amount and sort of continue that, because that also pushes the idea of manufacturing debt, and that pushes the problem of repaying that debt further and further into the future. But actually taking what's been available and redistributing it. So, for example, there's $1.75 trillion of sort of QE money available currently right now today to the mortgage market through the mortgage securities that the Fed still has on its balance sheet. You actually can redivert that money. All that process that we're talking about that could have happened 10 years ago, you know, financially, mathematically, you know, structurally, logistically, from a programming standpoint, can be made to happen. And I think that's where, these central banks need to really go in order to unwind what they've done. And this needs to be a process really throughout the world. If the European Central Bank has bought a bunch of corporate bonds and so has their money sort of available for that throughout Europe, but other European countries who didn't get that benefit are hurting, which ultimately hurts all of Europe, well, then you have to sort of dial back and redivert that money. Now, that requires, it's a level of democratization, it's a level of equality where we recognize these institutions, their leaders have to recognize what they have done. Like the first step to admitting a problem, fixing a problem is admitting it's actually occurring. This is an issue too, because Congress could, for example, require the Fed to do this, to say, look, you've done quantitative easing, we didn't stop you, didn't quite go where we thought it was supposed to go, let's make it go there. And financially, there's a way to restructure that money, same way banks restructure debt all day long. It's what they do. It's not difficult, but it does require an ideological will. And that is difficult because right now there is a narrative that pervades everywhere that this has been good because the markets are up and the banks didn't fail and no major collapse happened after and after the first set. And there is this embrace of these policies, and it won't be until the debt that's been created because of this cheap money quantitative easing throughout the world starts to crack and things begin not being able to be repaid again, and economies start to fall because of that, and the banks start to complain again, and then the choices are, do we give them more money, or do we actually re-divert the money we've given into the debt, into the mortgages, into infrastructure, into development, into just any one of a number of like real productive economic growth oriented initiatives that don't rely on simply like throwing money from that helicopter into the hands of Jamie Dimon and hoping it'll, you know, sort of like find its way to, you know, sustainable growth.
Nomi Prinz, the book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Again, reminder, the show relies on its members for its support. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, we told you a while back about one of our listeners, Teacher Lauren, whose mom had gotten ill and needed some help. And apparently she was rejected for Social Security disability. It is a lot more stringent and difficult, I think, than people imagine. Rejects somewhere around 40, at least 40%, I think, maybe higher, of people who apply for disability benefits. She can no longer work. Longtime listener. We will put a link to Teacher Lauren's mom's GoFundMe page up in our both at majority.fm and in the show notes. So if you have the opportunity and the ability to do that, please do. If you're looking to help someone out who could use some help. Also, don't forget today is Wednesday, which means yesterday was Tuesday, which means yesterday was TMBS day. If I remember correctly, at least Mike Hanna was on the show.
Correct. Mike Hanna and Cody Johnstone. And I want to let who used to be at Cracked.
Yes.
And I want to let everybody know, too, that this past Sunday, the illicit history was with Mark Blythe on the Eurozone. It was really good.
Check that out, Mark Blythe. For the accent alone.
We were talking about this, that he could be like, and this is where the bacteria comes in. Like, he could be explaining how yogurt is made, and right, you're just like transfit.
Yeah, he had a good take. It's not much different than what we've said on here about Trump, but he had an interesting take on that. That was interesting, especially because of his voice,
which also like weaved with why like what's happening in Spain. The guy knows how to connect stuff.
Jamie, who is on the Antifa? Oh, you had questions, right, this week?
Yeah, we had questions. We're kind of on a summer schedule right now, but we're getting back on track this weekend with a show that's going to be great.
Summer schedule.
It's a surprise.
And Matt, are you also on a summer schedule?
No, I'm sort of on a year-round summer schedule. It's every two
nice.
First and third Saturdays. So the third Saturday is this one. It's going to be Rip Van Winkle. It's on iTunes. I got 19 reviews on iTunes. They're all really nice. So
sweet.
Thanks to people.
There you go. Literary hangover. All right.
Mike Hanna was like, "How high is Matt Leck, Michael?"
Did he ask it?
No, he didn't ask that.
He was that high.
He was Mike Hanna, Al Jazeera.
He was
literary hang-up.
That high.
Five stars.
All right.
It turned out he was.
646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half.